From the authentic soul of Bernie Siegel, MD, comes Mind Health Matters, a show that reflects Bernie's passion to reach people struggling with all of life's challenges, not just the physical ones, so that each person can live life fully with the understanding that, as Bernie reminds us, we only have today. Believing that we are all here to love one another, each in our own unique way, Bernie has crafted eternal truths and the timeless wisdom of the ages. Join Bernie as he shares his powerful journey through life while offering us special nuggets of his sacred wisdom.
Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Bernie's show, Mind Health Matters. And we have, I'm really glad to be with everyone today. Lionel is off, and we are together, Bernie and I, and he has an amazing guest today, Katie Butler, who is an award-winning journalist, public speaker, and best-selling author. She has written two groundbreaking books about the end of life and is a thought leader in the National Movement for Medical Reform, which is so needed. Her first book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to Better Way of Death, a national bestseller, was named one of the 100 most notable books of 2013 by the New York Times. This, if you're tuning in for the first time, this is a Dream Vision 7 radio network broadcast. We are the media partner for the Omega Institute, and Bernie's show is heard Wednesday through Friday, 12 a.m. and 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And so, Bernie, take it away with your wonderful guest, Katie Butler.
I hope
there's
time for us to talk to Katie, because what she did is so interesting to me. I start telling stories, and then there's no time left. But Katie's book, The Art of Dying Well. And I just have to share, as a physician, because I found that was one of the most difficult things at the hospital or anywhere else. Story number one. A friend of mine was in the hospital, and I was making rounds, and I said to the secretary, "How's Alan doing?" She said, "He Brady'd." I said, "What are you talking about? He Brady'd." What I realized was the morgue at Yale New Haven Hospital is in the Brady building.
Oh.
So she couldn't even use the word he died. And I thought, you know, how sick this is. How many terms we have, passed away, crossed the bridge. Why don't you just say somebody died? These are things that I saw that I was never prepared for, you know, in so-called medical training. You're not trained for
death. And I think this use of euphemisms, which extends far beyond just simply dying, into being clear with people about what the future holds for them, really can be very disempowering for patients. And what I wanted to do in the book is create some common language with doctors to coach people in ways to talk to doctors so they can re-empower themselves and have some clarity about where they are in the journey.
Yeah, my family, in-laws and parents and wife, who died a little over a year ago, all had no trouble dying. I mean, let me just share one story, because, and also the guilt and blame, because I did a lot of children's surgery, and I would tell the parents, look, do not be upset if your child dies when you go to the cafeteria for lunch. They'd think they're doing you a favor. And I knew my mother was like that. She would never die with her doctor's son, you know, who's saving all these lives, sitting in the room with her. I mean, she was a great example, way outlived all expectations by her doctors. But I would leave the room every few hours so that when I came back one time, they said, oh, your mother just, you know, passed. And I knew I'm not feeling guilty. This is what she wanted. But my father, who had he said one day, I need to get out of here. And his mother said, oh, he wants to get out of bed. I said, no, Mom, he wants to get out of his body. And he's looking for you to say okay. So she said okay, and he said, I'll die Sunday. And we said, okay, we'll have a big party and invite everybody. And we got the list, about 24 people going to come to the hospital. That morning I went out to take a walk before I went to the hospital, and I hear voices. It's my angel talking to me. And I hear a voice say, how did your parents meet? I said, I don't know. Then ask your mother when you get to the hospital. So when I get to the hospital, before I could even say, I love you, I'm sorry, out of me pops, how did you two meet? And my mother started telling a story how she was on vacation with some girls she didn't know, who she learned later had a terrible reputation. And coming down the beach were a bunch of boys, including my future father, and she said they tossed coins and your father lost and got me. Everybody started laughing. And then the stories went on. I mean,
that's so beautiful. And yeah, I think it really outlines, Bernie, one of the points of my book.
Let me finish.
So I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
Make your point, because the next day she fell off a boat into the water. I mean, I was thinking, why did you go out with him anymore? But I looked over at my father, who was in a coma, and big smile on his face, color in his cheeks. I thought, he's looking so well, he's going to open his eyes and say, I'm not dying today, this is fun. But again, intuitively, when the last person who told us, I'm coming, walked in the room and we announced her, my father took his last breath and died looking so wonderful. There wasn't a person in the room who was afraid of death. And I'm talking about little grandchildren who were there, you know, shaking like, well, he's going to die. What's going to happen? And, you know, they looked up and like, wow, you know, there's nothing to worry about. Yeah.
And what's so beautiful to me about your story is that we don't want to die as a diagnosis or a bundle of diagnoses. Mm. And I think it's so important that we actually make almost a conscious effort to bring in the relational and the spiritual and the emotional parts of our lives, not only when we're actually dying, but as my book really starts out at the point of life that I call resilience, which is just before you've gotten that bad diagnosis and when you're just, you know, you're feeling the brush of death on your shoulder because you're aging, but you're actually doing pretty well still. It's so important that we integrate this sense of ourselves as fully human all the way through whatever encounters we have with the medical system. And as you know, Bernie, I have loved your work for decades. You sponsored a cancer support group that my mother attended decades and decades ago, and I was so moved by your work and that your book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles. It really has helped shape my whole life and my approach to this, so I just want to give you a big thank you for that.
Thank you. I think when you come from your heart, it changes everything. Let me say why I say we don't get a medical education, we get medical information. Why you need to be talking to all the doctors of the world. Because in one of the medical journals, there was an article entitled, Not on My Shift. And I'm reading it. It turns out in the intensive care unit, there are 8-hour shifts, 3 doctors.
Right.
Each time their shift was over, the one would come out and say to the next one, not on my shift. And who they were talking about was this man who was close to death. And they were not letting him die. They were showing off. Look what I can do. I can keep him alive 8 more hours. And finally, the person who wrote this article said, I realized, what the hell are we doing to this man? You know?
Yes.
I mean, he's not alive. He's lying in an intensive care unit, and we're keeping him from being dead. So he let him die in that shift. And I'd say that was a gift to that guy. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, I am sure you are familiar with this term, moral distress, which is the pain that a lot of intensive care unit nurses especially and doctors feel when they feel they are being forced, really, by the protocols of the hospital or conditions like what you just described to put people through pain that they know is not going to result in a turning around and a magical recovery. I mean, obviously, you want to be in an ICU if you've got some chance of a magical recovery. But when you're in stage 4 cancer and nobody's ever talked to you about where things are going, or you've got multiple chronic illnesses and you're in your 90s, you're fragile, you're on your last legs, this is not where you want to die. And in the book, I really try to say to people, it's not enough to just say, I don't want to die plugged into machines, right? Or don't let me, you know, if I get like that take me out and shoot me. People think of this as a single binary decision, like you're going to just let people know that and everything's going to be fine. But the real truth is that through the passage of a serious illness over time, or just plain aging over time, we face multiple micro decisions that we need to make about, and as you said, to stay in touch with our heart and with our gut sense and our common sense about what makes my life worth living. How do I amplify my comfort, my joy, the meaning of my life, whether or not I'm struggling with a serious disease?
Because I use a lot of dreams and drawings of patients. And just what you're saying, you say, draw your treatment. And literally, the picture showed the devil giving her poison. I mean, you know, that's not her choice. That's some doctor telling her, you know, you can't die and you got to go through all this. And I learned to empower people. And let me, you know, even the sense of humor. Because I would say to people, if you need to die, it's okay. Your love will stay with us. Yeah. And one guy, when I said, if you need to go, it's okay, he said, I'm not going anywhere. And, you know, we both laugh. But then there was a family, because this is what people really need to realize, to empower themselves. One of the kids was a doctor, and the mother was in a coma. I was telling, if you need to go, it's okay. And the guy said, I'm not going anywhere. But the other that touched me, a family with a doctor as one of the children.
Yeah.
Mother is in coma, tube fed. Hospice, the lawyer at hospice kept saying, no, you can't pull the tube out and then bring her here to die. That's committing murder. So I said to the family when they called me for help, look, I'll take the tube out. Then you show up, she doesn't have a tube.
Yeah.
But when she showed up, the lawyer came after them and said, no, we're not letting her in. So I told them to bring her to the hospital. And then I came over when she was admitted. And I said to the family, tell your mother, it's okay to go. Your love will stay with us. And they all started crying. I can't deny him. So I said, look, I'm going to speak for you. And I went over to the mother next to her, you know, bed. I said, your family is sitting in the room with me. They want you to know if you need to go, it's okay. Your love will stay with them.
Yeah.
Within 15 minutes, she died.
Wow.
And all the IVs,
it's so beautiful,
you know, everything is running.
Burning.
What?
It's so beautiful. What you're saying is so beautiful. And I think we just, doctors and nurses and all of us who are not in the medical professions, we need to just get in touch with this common sense. And that's why in my book I have a lot of stories about people who just rise to the occasion and speak from their heart and do what needs to be done and not be intimidated by the protocols of the hospital or people who seem to know more than they do.
Yeah, and the stories
I, like the,
I found are what change people. That's why reading your book can be very helpful, if you know what I mean.
You.
Because the story, it's not about statistics. It's about people and their stories. And that's what we all need to share and know about.
Yes. And I was really surprised by, I mean, I don't want to over-idealize the idea of a good death, but I was really surprised by stories of people like Kathy Doobie, who had had a very difficult relationship with her mother all through her life and had never remembered her mother ever saying, I love you. Her mother had beaten her and been alcoholic, but she flew in when her mother was really at the edge of death and in the hospital. And even though the mother had said, don't come, I don't want to see you. And she came into the room, and the mother just said, I love you, and I'm sorry. And the daughter said back, I love you, and I'm sorry. And that was it.
So powerful.
But for, so powerful. And Kathy said to me, those few moments cleared up a lifetime of misunderstanding each other. So she was left with a positive emotional legacy of her mother's passing.
Right.
And I just really encourage people to take advantage of any opening, any opportunity that presents itself. I was at a conference recently on end of life, and next to me sitting was a woman who'd had her wedding in the ICU unit, well, it was a bone marrow transplant unit, where her dad was, and her dad walked her down the aisle, which was the hospital corridor. And this was not only healing for her, tremendously healing for her. She was an African-American woman, and there is a lot of distrust, understandably, in the African-American community about hospitals and dying and healthcare. She was left with a beautiful emotional legacy, and so were the nurses on that transplant unit, because they got to support this rite of passage. And I just think there are a lot more opportunities than we think to take over the space, bring in an electric candle into a death that's occurring in a hospital, ask for a private room, ask for the telemetry to get turned off so you don't listen to beepers and monitors and, you know, takings of vital signs. We have opportunities to, as you say, really come from the heart, act from the heart. There are more opportunities than we think to shape the nature of how we end our lives. We're not going to control it. We do have the capacity to shape it.
Right. Yeah, I've learned to just ask people, when did your loved one die?
Yeah.
Now, when they say 2 o'clock in the morning, I know that, you know, was not a healed situation, and I try to help them. But if they say, oh, my father died at 2 in the afternoon with everybody in the room, you know, loving him, they don't need me, if you know what I mean. They did it right. And most people die in the hospital in the middle of the night because the family isn't there to make you feel guilty and the doctor isn't there to, resuscitate you. And when I was an intern at the hospital, I used to wonder, why the hell do they always wake me up at night, you know, when people are dying? I wasn't smart enough to realize that, because if you're in bed, they know you won't come rushing in and stop them from dying. So that's why they wait till you leave and, you know, go to bed, and then they die. But, these are things we need to be made aware of, and just what you're talking about and writing about.
And I think the average family doesn't know all of the kind of secret protocols and hidden rules of the medical institutions. For example, the fact that until the family gets it together to say with a united voice, no, or it's time to stop, or no, we don't want to put dialysis into this terrible situation where the person's already in the ICU, or whatever it is, they don't understand that in most hospitals the protocol is to treat until the family gets it together to say no. And if you don't know these hidden rules, it's very easy to kind of lose your way. And if you do know them and you trust your own voice, it's easier than you think to shape the event so it's more positive for you and the dying person.
Yeah, we have to keep our power, and it's not about guilt.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did a lot of children's surgery, and that, dying children can break your heart. But one old boy with cancer, I remember him, when I was in the room with him, saying to me, why am I dying? Why am I going through this? What popped out of my mouth, and I don't know where it came from, was because it makes you beautiful.
Wow.
And I turned around to say, I'm sorry, for what I just said, because it didn't make sense to me. He's dying, and I'm telling him he's beautiful. But the look on his face was gorgeous. He had this big smile, and it healed me and melted me, because, you know, the child has better understanding than I did of the whole situation and what he was doing and showing others.
Yes, there's a wonderful, she was a divinity person named Megory Anderson, who wrote a book called Sacred Dying that I also mention in my book. She tells the story of a little girl who's dying of cancer in the hospital and is full of guilt about the time she was mean to her brother and the fact that she isn't recovering and all the money and care and angst her parents have gone through as a result of her sickness. And what Megory did was take a sheet and tie a knot in the sheet for every one of this little girl's guilts, and then they called the family in and they named every guilt, and one by one they untied all the knots in the sheet, and the family cried and hugged her, and I think she died that night. The little girl died that night. But I'm very keen on these improvised rites of passage that can help bring dignity and meaning and acknowledgement and community to what we go through.
Let me tell you a perfect example for what you said. This child had cancer. Her mother, since she died, has done incredibly wonderful things for her. But she was traveling around the world trying to save her daughter's life, and I got involved with her. And then I do a lot of work with drawings because people know when they're going to die. I mean, often the symbol, the purple, spiritual, you'll see a purple kite going up in the sky or something like that. People know intuitively, unconsciously, when they are going to die. And they will show it on a piece of paper. If you give them crayons and say, draw a picture, they will know in a dream. In other words, it comes in symbols. And this wonderful little girl drew a picture with a purple balloon going up out of the, you know, the picture she drew. And I knew she was ready. But there were a lot of colorful decorations around it that confused me, little colorful things. But I knew what she was saying. So I said to the mother, take her home and love her. You know, stop running all over the planet trying to cure her disease. The other is what's interesting intuitively. She drew a picture of a girl crying in yellow, which is a healthy energy color. And I thought, this is crazy. You're ready to die? And she said, that's not me. That's the kid in the next room crying.
Oh,
that,
wow.
See, that impressed me, that even she intuitively knew if you're drawing the kid in the next room, you switch colors. But I told her mom, and I'll make this quick if we have to take a break, to take her home and love her. And she did. And I got a call one day, Bernie, today's my birthday. Amber woke up and said, Mom, I'm dying today as a gift to you to free you from all the trouble. And those little dots on the page were the number of days she had left in her life.
Well, we need to take a break, everyone. Stay with us. Don't go away. Back with Dr. Bernie Siegel.
And Katie Butler.
Join Dr. Bernie Siegel on Mind Health Matters every week, Wednesday through Friday, 12 p.m. and 12 a.m. Eastern Time on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. Bernie will draw from his inspirational personal journey, offering us special nuggets of his sacred wisdom. Listen in as Bernie reminds us to be fully engaged in life.
Omega Institute, offering workshops, retreats, and online learning dedicated to awakening the best in the human spirit. For over 40 years, Omega has seen more than 1 million people come through its doors to grow, learn, and find a greater sense of purpose. With over 350 workshops to choose from, Omega offers something for everyone. Located in Rhinebeck, New York, just 90 miles north of New York City, Omega's natural environment and quiet pace allow for extraordinary experiences to unfold. Learn more at eomega.org or call 877-944-2002. Again, 877-944-2002.
Dr. Bernie Siegel's writings and the 12 books he's published so far reflect his passion to reach people struggling with all of life's challenges. His latest, A Book of Miracles, inspiring true stories of healing, gratitude, and love, is both riveting and belief-expanding. Bernie has produced wonderful resources for everyone, like 365 Prescriptions for the Soul, daily messages of inspiration, hope, and love, and Faith, Hope, and Healing. Bernie's books also include those like Love, Magic, and Mud Pies, a great resource for parents, and delightful, loving stories like Buddy's Candle to help children of all ages cope with the loss of a loved one, be it a pet or a parent. To purchase Bernie's books, CDs, or DVDs, go to BernieSiegelMD.com. And while you're there, empower the mind, body, and spirit with Bernie's heartwarming articles.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Mind Health Matters with Dr. Bernie Siegel. For some information, if you'd like to save on some of his items, you can go to Wisdom of the Ages for any of his books. And when ordering, you place code 27 in the comment box and save 15%. Wisdom of the Ages is owned by his son and daughter-in-law, Jane and Keith Siegel. And you can go on wisdomoftheages.biz, not .com, .biz, B-I-Z. Dr. Bernie Siegel is talking with Katie Butler. She is award-winning journalist and best-selling author, and we're talking about her newest book, which is The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. What's interesting, I thought, Katie, too, your background as a journalist, you have interviewed Richard Nixon, of all people, so what a fascinating background you have. Also, if anyone would like to learn more about Katie Butler, go on her site. It's katiebutler.com. Katie is K-A-T-Y, katiebutler.com. Back to you, Bernie.
All right.
Thank you so much. And with that intro, I just love to say, I was a journalist until my dad had a fairly difficult passage through the end of life, and that made me really want to examine, almost like an anthropologist, what was going on in American medicine and why had we lost our way so seriously, especially toward the end of life in medicine. And the second book I did is really an attempt to give people workarounds, stories that will inspire them, ways to deal with what's often quite a broken and fragmented medical system, as well as, of course, as we've discussed, a culture that is very hesitant to talk about aging or sickness or death.
Right. You know, what's problematic about medicine is it has chopped people up into pieces. And I sent an article to a medical journal, came back saying, interesting but not appropriate. You know, that was about dreams, drawings, all these wonderful mystical things. So I sent it to a psychiatry journal. It was sent back saying, it's appropriate, but it isn't interesting. And that's the problem. If we're treating somebody, we need to know the whole person. You know, their spiritual side, their mystical side, as well as their mechanical side. But if you treat people like a car,
and the problem is that the system is so fragmented, so you have people hopping from ologist to ologist and silo to silo, and then being expected to abandon the doctors that they've come close to because now they need palliative care or now they should shift completely over to new providers for hospice. We're really expecting. Oh, and then doctors are surprised when, close to the end of life, where there's been no discussion of these issues, they kind of, dump this knowledge on people, and families are in shock and can't accept it, and then we're surprised. I think that everyone in the healthcare system needs to forgive themselves, though, because we're all trying to do our best within broken systems.
Well, here's some more wonderful stories. When people are prepared to die, many of them don't. Now, why? A millionaire in Florida. 2 months to live. So his wife said, well, why don't we buy the house on the ocean you always wanted? We'll listen to Bernie's tapes. We'll do all those things. He lived 5.5 years. And what I got a kick out of, when he was introducing me once in Miami, I said, why do you dress like that? I mean, he was so casual, I thought it was improper. We're at this special event. And he said, when they tell you you're going to die in 2 months, you cancel the dress code at work. I have never worn a tie since then. I can't put it on because of him. Another gentleman in our group, I'm going to Colorado to die in the mountains. It's so beautiful there. I said to the family, call me, I'll come to the funeral. Year goes by, no phone call. So I called them to say, why didn't you care about me and my feelings and I wanted to come? Yeah. He answered the phone. He said,
well, and I think this whole idea that you need to be.
I forgot to die.
It's like some of the advice that I've heard cancer patients get is do what you love. Do what you love.
The heart.
Yes, exactly. And we don't have to, and usually doctors are really very wrong in the predictions that they give of how long people have to live. In any case.
I mean, let me, because I can't help but keep saying, you know, that just what you're saying, that when doctors take hope away, we're not going to fix your cataracts because you have cancer and we'll be dead in 6 months. Yeah. So he died in a week, lying in bed at home.
Yeah.
But, and I knew that with my wife. That's part of what got me into this. God knows how many years ago she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I was told what was going to happen, and I'm going to end up with 5 kids and, you know, be a single parent and blah, blah, blah. That's when I got into holistic medicine and hope and, you know, alternatives. And, yeah, and she outlived her doctors. And the nice part was, I mean, she was home all the time. And one morning I got up, and I thought she was still sleeping, so I didn't, you know, disturb her. Then I came back to the bedroom to get her up because we were having care at home.
Yeah,
she looked so peaceful. But when I touched her, I realized she had died. But, you know, she had died so peacefully. Everything was exactly in place.
Well, and I think we have to, I want to challenge you here. I think we also have to reconfigure the meaning of hope. I mean, one hope is to conquer this disease or not die. And then there are other hopes, like I want to write letters for my children to open on these landmark birthdays and graduations that I'm not going to be there for, probably.
Yeah,
you know, I want to take this so-called last year of life and get in an RV and go across the country and visit national parks. I mean, these are some of the things people do when they reconfigure. You can't have a narrow conception of hope. A friend of mine who was a Zen carpenter, he wanted to know that he was going to leave his wife with a renovated little cabin, basically, that they lived in, with no mortgage. And they achieved that so that when he died, he felt comfortable knowing that she was going to be okay when he was gone. So I think, frankly, doctors have too narrow a conception of hope, and then they don't give people enough information to make realistic plans.
Hope is not statistical. I'd be giving a lecture, and somebody would get up and say, when I say somebody, a doctor in the audience, you're giving false hope. You know, I said, what is false hope? It's an oxymoron. If you buy a lottery ticket, you know, do you ever win? You know, so it's not statistical to have hope. And I learned to give, well, even in my website, I have an article, Deceiving People into Health. I got people well by lying to them. See?
But then how do you deal then with the conflict of someone really is dying, and they're saying, or their family is saying something like, mom's a fighter, and she's in the ICU, she's got 4 different diagnoses, she hasn't, you know, she hasn't spoken in 17 days.
Yeah.
You know, I worry about...
It's not a fight, that's the point.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of Alex Trebek and wish I could talk to him. Because there's so many articles in the paper fighting the battle, you know. It's not a battle. It's not a war. You're not a loser if you die. It's about healing your life.
Yes, but let me tell you a story from my book. I'm really interested in what you would have to say about it. So there's a woman named Amy Berman, and she's a nurse, and she was diagnosed with inflammatory breast cancer. And the first doctor she went to, the nationally prominent expert in her cancer, told her to go through chemo, radiation, mastectomy, and then a different round of chemo. And she actually is an RN. She's an expert in palliative care. And she basically said, look, this is already metastasized to the bone. We're going to destroy my quality of life now, and then I'm going to bump along for who knows how long, and my health is going to be really damaged. I don't like this pathway. And so she basically fired that doctor and left, and she went back to another oncologist who said, what do you want to accomplish? And I think that's such a much more important question than this is what we're going to do. And she said exactly that. She wanted a Niagara Falls trajectory. She wanted to stay as healthy as possible for as long as possible and then have a quick decline because she really felt she knew her time was going to be limited. She's now 9 years out from her diagnosis. The only treatment she's done, what do you call it, estrogen suppressing therapy, so she takes a pill that suppresses her estrogen levels. And she's had one burst of very focused palliative radiation to destroy some of the cancer cells that were creating pain for her in her back. That's it. And she has, she still works, she's gone to China, she's seen her daughter graduate, but she remained in the driver's seat. But I would say that false hope would have actually been a bad thing for her. For her, being honest about the fact that she had a stage 4 cancer and that she wanted to manage it but not fix it and she wanted to focus on quality of life was much more important to her than we're going to go all out and do this kind of, you know, scorched earth policy and hope that that leads to a so-called cure that is not in the books.
Yeah. See, the reason I bring that up is several. One is doctors take away hope. You know, you have 2 months to live. And people go home and die in a month. And I've told some families to sue their doctors. And they have. And their insurance companies for these stupid comments they make to them and take all their hope away. So hope, you know, as I say, it's not about statistics. It's about an opportunity. So you want to do it? Fine, do it. I mean, again, when I tell you these stories, you know, you have a lawyer. Yeah. Why are you a lawyer? My parents wanted me to be a lawyer. I always wanted to be a violinist. Yeah. You have a few months to live. Close the office, and I'll play my violin. Years later, he was in an orchestra playing a violin.
Yes,
so it's,
yes.
It's getting people to not try to avoid dying, but to live, let your heart make up your mind is the way I like to put it. I have people with pets and children who don't die because of them. I mean, these are quotes. I can't die till they're all married and out of the house. 9 kids.
Right.
20 years later, the last one left home, that's when mama died. That's what blows my mind. See, how do you keep a cancer under control for 20 years? Well, I can't die.
God.
I had a woman with 12 cats. Her kids came in and said, look, our mother has cancer. She needs all these treatments. We'll get rid of the cats, clean her house, because we don't even visit. It stinks in there.
Oh,
I said, no. They looked at me like, no. I said, your mother's dead if you take away her cats. So what you do is go in, clean up, and tell your mother no one wants 12 cats. And they came into the office for years, you know, smiling at, you know, the wise Dr. Siegel who told them to clean the house and leave the cats.
I love what you were saying earlier, that we know when we're dying. We don't, you know, that it'll come out in dreams and in paintings. And in the book, I mean, you probably know a lot more about this, but I was surprised to learn about people get visitations from a coyote, or they see a man on the ridgepole of the building next to them, and he's wearing a top hat and tails, or they go to, they come, you know, you come in the next morning, and they say they were at a party with their dead wife and their, you know, dead relatives, and they get these visitations from the dead, or they go to a party, or they say things like, I need to pack, or I need to move to a higher floor of the nursing home, or I need to go on this journey, and that we're speaking and knowing these things in these intuitive terms. And I believe, and you probably know much better than me, that those stories are a much better guide to what is about to happen than looking at a scan, you know, and saying whether the tumor grew or not.
Hold that thought now, Bernie. We need to take our next break, everyone. Don't go away. We'll be back more with Dr. Bernie Siegel and Katie Butler.
Join Dr. Bernie Siegel on Mind Health Matters every week, Wednesday through Friday, 12 p.m. and 12 a.m. Eastern Time on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. Bernie will draw from his inspirational personal journey, offering us special nuggets of his sacred wisdom. Listen in as Bernie reminds us to be fully engaged in life.
Dr. Bernie Siegel's writings in the 12 books he's published so far reflect his passion to reach people struggling with all of life's challenges. His latest, A Book of Miracles, inspiring true stories of healing, gratitude, and love, is both riveting and belief-expanding. Bernie has produced wonderful resources for everyone, like 365 Prescriptions for the Soul, daily messages of inspiration, hope, and love, and Faith, Hope, and Healing.
Bernie's books also include those like Love, Magic, and Mud Pies, a great resource for parents, and delightful, loving stories like Buddy's Candle to help children of all ages cope with the loss of a loved one, be it a pet or a parent. To purchase Bernie's books, CDs, or DVDs, go to BernieSiegelMD.com. And while you're there, empower the mind, body, and spirit with Bernie's heartwarming articles.
Looking for a fun and relaxing getaway? Omega's Rest and Rejuvenation Retreats are a great way to unwind and renew your spirit. Stroll through the garden, relax by the lake, or try a daily yoga or movement class. You can stretch your body, quiet your mind, and do as much or as little as you choose. Located in Rhinebeck, New York, just 90 miles north of New York City, Omega's natural environment and quiet pace allow for extraordinary experiences to unfold. Learn more at eomega.org.
After narrowly surviving the attack on Sandy Hook Elementary, first grade teacher Caitlin Roig DeBellis was left searching for answers that would never come. Eventually, she chose to focus on questions that could be answered. How do I make sure this tragedy doesn't define us? How do we get our control back? Those two questions led her to found the 501c3 nonprofit organization Classes for Classes. When gifts poured into their classroom, she decided they would help someone else by paying it forward and being kind. This developed into a social network which allows K-8 classrooms to connect so that every student in the United States can learn these crucial lessons. Classes for Classes' mission is to build students' social-emotional intelligence by connecting them to care. All C4C projects are crowdfunded. Any teacher in the U.S. can visit classesforclasses.org. That's classes, the number 4, classes.org. Sign up today.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
Okay, we're back. Again, I wanted to mention that Dr. Bernie's show, Mind Health Matters, is on the Dream Vision 7 radio network Wednesday through Friday, 12 a.m. and 12 p.m. Eastern Time. You can go on Dream Visions, all one word with an S on the end, the number 7radio.com. You can also listen to him in various ways, whether it be online, in your car with Bluetooth, on any of your mobile devices. You could be in Sweden riding around and listening to Bernie's show. So we have all the bells and whistles in the technology area. To get a hold of Bernie, you can go on his site. It's BernieSiegelMD.com. Siegel is S-I-E-G-E-L, BernieSiegelMD.com. And for his guest, Katie Butler, you can go on her site. Her books are there and all the goodness that she is doing in elevating the human race. It's Katie Butler, K-A-T-Y, Butler.com. And now that we're back, I wanted to ask Katie, with reading the book, all the myths around hospice are listed in the book, and I was just, it was good to learn all of these things. So could you share a couple of those myths, Katie, for us, for the listeners?
Yes. One, of course, is that hospice is a building, whereas actually in America, hospice is a benefit provided by insurance and by Medicare. A lot of people think that hospice is only good for like the last 3 or 4 days of life, a period that nurses often call active dying. But the reality is you can be on hospice for 6 months or sometimes even longer. And one of the stories in my book is about a woman with pancreatic cancer who's in her 80s who works up until 6 weeks before she dies. And she's on the hospice benefit for 9 months before she dies. So because hospice is so good at things like pain control, which often have devastated people's quality of life, they go on hospice, they get really good pain control, they get the kind of thinking and talking that Bernie gives people about what matters to you, what do you love, do what you love, let's figure out how you can continue to do what you love, and as a result, they they perk up, they get off a lot of drugs that have been causing them pain or difficulty, and they actually outlive people who are pursuing maximum treatment sometimes quality of life.
Let me add something, because I tell people, if you want a good hospice, go in and say, do you have any dropouts or graduations? Because there are many hospices who take such good care of people, the people finally say, you know, I'm feeling so much better. I'm going to go home. So they have a party.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And about 15% of people go disenroll from hospice as a result of improved well-being, you know. So that's one of them. Another one, of course,
and
is
let me, just one more, because the power of this. Hospice started where I live in Connecticut.
That's right.
In Branford.
Yeah.
And what it meant, though, like the first day it opened its door, was you go there to die. So when somebody would say, okay, we'll let you go to hospice, literally people got in the car or an ambulance and died on the way there.
Wow.
It was so powerful to realize, you know, what the fact meant to them, you're going to hospice. And that's when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross became a friend of mine and everything else. You know, we really got into the fact of how the mind means something to people. Because if the car pulled up in front of your house with the name hospice on it, oh, I'm dead, you know? Mm-hmm. And now it has a very different
meaning.
Yeah,
but a lot of people, I mean, this, like the lady in my book, she was on a chemo that really she had a terrible reaction to, and she was skeletal, and her family thought she had just weeks, and so she goes on hospice, and everything turns around. So another one of the myths is that hospice covers round-the-clock home care, and unfortunately this is not true. Hospice workers will come into the home to visit, the nurses, the doctors, the social worker, the PT, but they're not going to be there changing the diapers or feeding somebody. And that's why I really emphasize in the book the importance of having a tribe to deepen your relationships with your neighbors and your friends, to do favors for people when you can, to mentor people who are younger than you, to do all these things, because people who have a good, rich social network are more likely to have the hands-on care from their friends that they are likely to need as they're going through their dying process.
Yeah, my wife was home all the time. I mean, there were times she'd go to the hospital and if something acute happened. But otherwise, with palliative care, they called it, and all these wonderful people came and spent the day, and then, you know, we'd tuck her in at night and get her up in the morning, and as when everybody came again, you know, at 9 in the morning.
Yes, and there was a really beautiful story on TV about a community, rural community in Utah, where a woman had multiple sclerosis, and I think she was living alone or with the help of a daughter or son, and all the neighbors got together, and all these men, like I think a huge group of men, like 10 or 20 men, all rotated, and they each of them would take a shift in the evening and help put her to bed. And that made it possible for her to continue to live at home for, I think, many years. And in the end, the men in the community were almost fighting over to have a slot to put her to bed. And I think it was a beautiful thing for them, as men, too, to learn to be good caregivers.
Yeah, let me add something I had to learn. Traveling to every state in the Union, I have. Mm-hmm. And you learn something. Upstate Maine, Montana.
Yes.
Everybody knows everybody else.
Yes.
Because if something goes wrong, you know, your neighbors come. I mean, in one place, you blew your horn on the car endlessly. And then all the neighbors drove over knowing you had a problem. But it really impressed me, because the attitude towards the patient was so different in Montana than in New York. And you'd think, oh, New York, all these wonderful cancer centers. But Montana has a better survival rate than New York. And I'd say the same thing in upstate Maine.
Mm. Exactly. And I think those of us in blue states who think we're so sophisticated, we have a lot to learn from the rural people in red states around neighborliness and mutual obligation and community. A lot. It's beautiful, and I think it's quite humbling.
Yeah, I learned
so
it.
Those are,
when our car broke down in New York, in Manhattan, and the cops went by without even stopping to see if we're okay, we'll send somebody.
Yeah.
Car broke down in the middle of nowhere in Texas. Somebody pulled up and said, what happened? I said, well, the car stopped working. Oh, my brother's a mechanic. I'll get him. You come with me, you know, and your wife, and you'll have dinner at our house while he fixes your car.
Beautiful. Yes, beautiful. And I think the more we get back to that kind of spirit, which is, it builds our own self-confidence when we help out other people like this and go the extra mile for other people, we feel better. We feel better physically and mentally, and we have more confidence in ourselves and in our community and less fear. And I think all of this will help us have a better process through the ends of our lives, which of course we're all going to go through at some point. You know, another problem with hospice, however, is that there are certain diagnoses where it's relatively easy to get into hospice, and I recommend getting into hospice or, as you said, palliative care, even better, earlier and sooner rather than later. But there's some diagnoses that move so slowly that it's hard to get into a hospice program. And a lot of people need at-home health care, and they don't necessarily have the money to pay for it out of pocket. And I think this is, again, it's a gap in our social safety net. We really ought to provide health care and home care at home for everyone who needs it, so they don't have to go into the hospital to get a certain level of care or respite for their family.
There's a lot of,
and I think that's another reason why people often have better health outcomes on hospice, because they're not having to, you know, ferry themselves from office to office when they're already fragile and very easily fatigued. So, it's
add another personal story. My father-in-law fell and was quadriplegic, but he was such a wonderful man, despite all his disabilities. I mean, he couldn't do anything. He just had a sense of humor and lived to 97.
Oh,
I was trying to get him to live to 100 so he'd get on television. But you know, then I thought, think what I'm trying to do. He's quadriplegic, and I want him to live 3 more years? So one night, you know, he said to the family, his wife, his daughter, myself, you know, enough. He said, I'm not having dinner, and I'm not taking my pills. And he died quietly that night.
Wow.
But
yes, it's fascinating.
If you let me drive him crazy, we would have kept him alive, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yes,
and his
advice
for seniors is fall on something soft, because that's how it happened, his injury.
Yeah.
Fall on something soft.
It's amazing. My mother was like that, too. She was a very decisive person all her life, and she had heart problems, and she had quite consciously rejected open heart surgery at the age of 84, and she knew she was going to die within a year or so, and she had something like a heart attack, we don't really know, and she was taken to the hospice unit of the local hospital, and she just said, I want to stop eating and drinking, I want to die, and I don't want to go back home again. And she died that night. You know, she sent my brother off to make a phone call to me and my other brother, and when he came back, she was dead. But it was so much the way she had lived. She was a very,
like
very decisive.
A switch. I always say it's like turning the light off.
Yeah.
You know, your mother could let her body know, I'm turning it off. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and she was done. And it was shocking for me, but I also had to realize she really had died the way she wanted to die.
Right.
You know, it was not necessarily the way I wanted her to die. I wanted to have a chance to fly out and say goodbye to her and see her before she actually died.
But then we're imposing.
That wasn't actually what she wanted.
Yeah. That's why I thought later, when I'm saying to him, you got to live a few more years, who am I to have, you know, make him live in his condition, just because I want to get him on television, you know. And so he's smart enough to say, no, enough is enough. And the other thing,
well,
the spiritual part, when my mother-in-law died, I used to have lunch with her and drive her crazy, you know, to get her to laugh, and she's a wonderful spirit. Because even in the midst of sitting in a wheelchair with enormous problems, I said to her, what can I pray for you? I wanted to do something. And she said, world peace. Can you imagine someone with every problem in the world, saying world peace. It blew my mind, and boy, did I respect her as a person. But the day she died, it was about 11:30. I knew it because she came and said goodbye to me. I don't know how to describe it. It was like this little sort of spirit cloud over my head saying goodbye. Yes. And I said, oh, she's gone. So I jumped up, got in the car, drove to her nursing home. And I walk in, and the nurse sees me and says, oh, you've heard. I said, I didn't hear. I know.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff. When you live it, you know, you don't argue about it. That's why I say the stories, nobody can say that really didn't happen. It did.
Exactly.
And, the reason I say 11:30, I thought she looked at her watch and said, oh, if I don't die now, he'll be here.
So yes, and I hope this is the beauty of my book, which is called The Art of Dying Well, is to help people get back in touch with this intuition, this spirituality, the things they want to have guide their lives, their declines, even their deaths, and not to give. I think we've delegated the management of dying to medicine, and medicine does a much better job of preparing, you know, of warding off death and preparing people for peaceful death. And we need to re-own this very intuitive knowledge that people had up until the 1900s when medicine started to be much more effective, which of course has been a wonderful blessing for all of us. But we need to, it's almost like a double awareness, I think. We need to enjoy and love our lives and at the same time be willing to accept the reality of our deaths and allow ourselves to trust the kind of things you're talking about, Bernie, the intuitions, the messages from elsewhere. I think
I was going to say
that's a perfect way to end the show. That's it for now. Stay tuned for the next episode of Mind Health Matters next time around.
Join us next time on Mind Health Matters with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Until then, remember, be fully engaged in life, loving every moment as your unique self. In going deep within to discover ourselves, we can also discover self-love. Then, when we let our hearts make up our minds, we connect what our bodies do so well to the power of love. We can boost our ability to grow and heal along with our self-esteem. The sense of empowerment that results from this mind-body connection is one related to self-induced healing. When you add spirit to that connection, making a mind-body-spirit connection, you nourish your soul. For more insight, go to BernieSiegelMD.com.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.